Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this weekend's edition, we're going to be focusing again on more of the commodities resource sector, starting off with comments on more of the metals, precious metals, and some of the base metals. And in the back half of the show, again, switching back over to energy, there's a lot of stocks, especially the big ones, that are doing well in the commodities sector. And we have even seen a little bit of life in some of the smaller stocks. But boy, oh boy, that life has been about a month and a half. So potentially still a lot of upside from here. But we all know nothing moves in a straight line. We're kicking off this weekend show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, let's start off with precious metals because, look, gold continues to be very strong. As we're recording this, gold is pretty much right at $2,400. Silver is a little bit above $28. Even recently, silver has been outperforming gold. But look, gold has been, I think, a lot more impressive in the sense of all-time highs being reached almost on a consistent basis and almost a consolidation of those highs. Matt, when you're looking at this run in gold, what are your thoughts? How much longer could this move and how much higher could it go?
Good to be joining you again, Corey. And look, we last spoke just in the aftermath of PDAC, where we'd just seen gold poke its head above 2,100. And at the time, I was cautious, as I think many were, understandably. We'd seen gold get rejected at roughly that 2,100 level three different times over just the past few years. But a lot has changed in the past 4 to 5 weeks since we spoke. And I'm convinced that this is the real deal. This is the real thing. Look, I mean, we were hoping to see a close above 2,100 for the March timeframe, and that would have been the first time that gold had ever closed on a monthly basis above 2,100. And we got that and more. We got a close to above 2,200. Of course, gold has taken off further from here, so that checked that box pretty definitively. And then silver was the next thing that I was looking for, to see if silver price action would confirm that this move is real. And it has. It broke convincingly above 26 and now 28, which were both key technical resistance levels. And so I think all the signs are pointing that this is a long-lasting move. And I would say the aspect that's even more beautiful from my perspective is that this move in precious metals has been driven almost entirely without the support of Western financial institutions and by and large, Western investors. This is a move that started with central banks, largely around the time period where the Biden administration cut Russia off of the SWIFT banking system in the aftermath of their invasion of Ukraine. And I think that's going to go down as a seminal event, at least from a gold bug's perspective. And probably can be pointed to as really the genesis of this move that we're now just reaping the benefits of. And we've seen a lot of speculative excitement in the Eastern world amongst Chinese-driven buying from retail investors and what have you. But from my perspective, the longer the Western world sits out this move, the better. So I'm encouraged that this has occurred by, you know, non-traditional buyers. Usually it's the Eastern buyers that are more contrarian oriented and the Western buyers that pile in when there's momentum. And we've really seen it flipped on its head for this move. So I think we're off to the races. And, you know, I don't think this is limited just to precious metals. I mean, turning to the juniors, on April 1st, we saw the TSXV break convincingly above its 200-day moving average for the first time in multiple years. And, you know, gold seems to serve as a bellwether for the broader metal space. This is not an immutable law of the universe that this will be the case in this circumstance as well. But more often than not, you'll see gold leading the way, only for the rest of the metals complex to follow. So, you know, this doesn't mean that there won't be pullbacks, consolidation periods, volatility. But for those with a time frame beyond, you know, 1 or 2 months, I think we're off to the races. It's an exciting time, no doubt.
Yeah, Matt, you said it's nice to have a call like this after so many years of being in the hurt locker. But I would also submit that in any bull market, when it really gets going, it climbs that proverbial wall of worry where people have that disbelief element. And we were talking a little bit about that just before the call, just is this too good to be true? But if you think back to it, last year in October, when gold really bottomed around the low 1800s, it closed the year on a bang. I mean, November had an all-time monthly and quarterly high, and then December, same thing, an all-time monthly, quarterly, and annual high. So it was already a shot across the bow that things had changed, but a lot of people still doubted it. Like you say, they wanted that 2100 to be cleared. Then it was cleared convincingly, and people still doubted it. And then they wanted to see silver confirmed, like you mentioned, and then that happened, and they're still doubting it. Is it possible that this is how all bull markets happen, where people that are closest to the sector doubt it the most? It seems like generalists are noting the moves in gold and the stocks more than the people in the sector are.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Shad. And I mean, sentiment has undoubtedly improved from where we were in late 2023. I mean, sentiment was so beaten down at that point. And that caused me to reverse course on our decision to build up cash. That's why we got aggressive between mid-October and mid-January and did four different financings, because I hadn't seen sentiment that poor since, I mean, I guess the depths of the COVID crash, but that was unrelated or not directly related to the metal sector. But I hadn't seen that sentiment as poor, since the 2011 through 2015 bear market. It's definitely improved somewhat. And we've seen, you know, share prices of most juniors are, you know, up 25, 50, even in some cases, 75% off of their 52-week lows. But there's still that healthy dose of skepticism out there, which I like as an investor. And I mean, within the MJG portfolio, I'm sure others may be seeing different things, but we've really only seen, you know, the juniors start to pick up, some momentum here in the past couple weeks. So it still feels very early in the move, and we're not seeing anything close to the, you know, junior feeding frenzy that one would see towards the top of a proper move in juniors that should make one cautious. So I agree with what you're saying. Even amongst the more seasoned junior investors, there's still that psychological damage that has been inflicted over the past couple years, and we're not in the euphoric phase by any means.
Matt, even the majors, though, those have kind of been lagging as well. When you consider the gold is at all-time highs, there's very few gold stocks, majors, mid-tiers, or juniors that are at all-time highs, maybe 10% of them at most. What does that mean, though, for the sector? When will these stocks finally start performing? Because we've gotten a lot of comments saying, look, I realize gold's doing well. Why isn't my portfolio doing better?
So slow and steady, Corey. I don't want this to be another 6 month flash in the pan. So I'm okay with this move being more drawn out than not, personally. And I mean, I think we are seeing positive momentum amongst the production stage names. You're right. The vast majority of them are not at 52 week highs. But you know, you can look at the Pan Americans or Equinox Golds of the world, and you know, some of these names have picked up a pretty substantial bid over the past 4 weeks. So I think for the sector as a whole to start getting closer to those all-time highs, we'll need a few quarters probably of these higher gold prices to actually reflect on the bottom line, companies to start raising their dividends, you know, increasing share buybacks, what have you. So I agree with what you're saying. And, you know, we can start to get more cautious when we see the gold stocks at large, you know, going to all-time highs. But in a lot of these names, we'd have to more than double from current levels for that to be in the equation. So more to come.
Well, Matt, like you mentioned at the onset, it's not just limited to gold. And like you say, gold is often the pace car. It often is the ringleader to get the metal sector going. We have seen silver respond, but look at how well copper has done. Copper's popping its head up again. And really, the copper majors have done a lot better than the precious metals majors. We've seen oil take back off again, and oil stocks have been ripping at all-time highs, the large producers. We've even seen some life in some of the other commodities, whether they be metals or even soft commodities. So it seems like a full-on commodities, full-court press here. What do you make of that backdrop in a year where everybody thought we'd be having a recession?
Yeah, well, we touched on copper quite a bit on our last call. As you know, I'm quite bullish on copper longer term, and actually a full third of our portfolio, 33% of our portfolio as of month end March, I define as copper focused. Sometimes there's overlap. A lot of these copper names also have a gold component, but we're very heavily weighted towards copper. And the price action has been encouraging. I mean, when we last spoke, copper had just poked its head above $4 for the first time in quite some time. Now we're up substantially higher. But, you know, one of the beauties of the setup in copper is that I don't think we start seeing a substantial supply response until we see at least $5.50 or $6 copper. And one could argue it'd have to go substantially higher from that before we see the big boys really get a move on with pushing forward these next generation of copper mines actually into production. And even once they get to that panic stage, of course, we're talking a 3 or 4 year lag for these mega projects. And that's if the groups execute on time and on budget. So I think the copper story is just getting started. But as of now, the moves amongst copper-related names have largely been confined to the producers. So that's encouraging. I would say within the MJG portfolio, we have not seen a lot of movement with one exception amongst our copper-focused positions. As of now, the money's flowing into the Freeports of the world, and Freeport's sitting right near its 52-week high. And also the intermediate producers have seen substantial moves. But similar to with gold, if this move is for real, and I do believe it is, it's just a matter of time before it trickles down to the junior patch. So we're going to remain patient, and we're clearly very well positioned as it comes to copper at the moment.
So Matt, let's talk portfolio management then, because look, a lot of these stocks, no matter what resource or commodity they're in, have rebounded. Some of the juniors, again, are double. Some are even triple where they were just a few months ago. Some are simply back to where they started the year. But that does change general valuations and even some sentiment around these stocks. We're seeing a lot of financings come out. I know that last time we chatted, you were pretty much fully deployed in the MJG fund, but what's your advice for people managing a portfolio of resource stocks here now, seeing them start to rebound, still have a lot of upside potentially, but again, valuations have changed.
That's right. As mentioned earlier, we have seen a lot of these companies come off of their lows for the year, even though we haven't seen a huge flood of money into the juniors as starting to begin. And it is true that a stock that is up 50, 75, 100% from its lows, without a fundamental catalyst, I should say, driving that move, just purely moving based off of a change in sentiment, a story like that is arithmetically less attractive than before the move. There's no denying that. However, keep in mind that many of these companies are coming off of extremely beaten down levels that we saw late last year and early this year. And as a group, the juniors haven't moved, and we haven't seen that feeding frenzy that would make one cautious to this point. And then also remember, a lot of these financings are still coming, at least as of now, with at least a half warrant sweetener, which needs to be factored into one's calculation when deciding whether or not to participate in a given deal. And particularly in junior bull markets, warrants can prove exceptionally valuable for investors. But taking a step back, I would say that each company and each given financing opportunity needs to be evaluated on its own merits, of course. And as part of any investment process on a given name, it's essential to estimate the company's expected value, as imperfect as that may be for the name that you're evaluating. So if what the company looks to be achieving is achieved, what would be the value there? And then adjusting that for the risk of that actually happening. Obviously, a very imperfect measure, especially in the junior patch where there's so much variability. But I still think that's an essential effort that one needs to take to just have a number in mind. And then as part of that process, also to determine the level at which you would start to take profits if you were to invest in a given private placement. And this would, of course, be absent a fundamental development that could change your calculus. But the thought process is, assuming nothing changes on the company level, I'm doing a deal here at 50 cents per se with a half warrant at 75 cents. At what level will I start to take money off the table if we see the share price, rise up to 70, 80 cents, 90 cents a buck, and there hasn't been a major change on the company level? Where do I start taking money off the table? And usually that profit taking level should be below what you deem the company's ultimate expected value to be, factoring in for the imperfection and the uncertainty inherent with estimating, what the company should be worth at the given time. So when you're thinking about these 50 to 100% moves that we've maybe seen in some of these juniors, in some cases quite quietly, and you're looking at a private placement that's off of the bottom that we saw earlier this year, late last year, it needs to be thought of within this context. And a company that maybe had 3x upside to its expected value. Maybe now has 2.5x upside or 2x upside to its expected value. And so as an investor, you have to factor that in, and it still could be a worthy bet, even if you're not getting it at its rock bottom lows.
Well, Matt, those are some good thoughts for investors to maybe pick off some of these private placements that have the half warrant or the warrant sweetener. But let's deal with the reality that most of the people listening to this interview probably aren't going to be in private placements. They're probably not going to get those warrants. So they see the financings as a drag on the stock's upward momentum. They see the warrants as an overhang in the price. And we're also seeing a lot of these life financings where they can immediately strip the warrant and sell them, you know, right the next day. Or there's these flow through funds where a lot of investors get into it for a tax break, but they don't really care about the company, the project. They care about the tax break. So maybe speak to the other side of this for all the people listening in that see these capital raises for the companies. There's that balance between dilution and building value, but there's also the danger of giving away the farm on some of these financings.
I mean, it's a good point. I think there's a strong argument to be made that if one could not invest in financings directly, then, you know, maybe one should avoid some of these higher risk juniors that have plenty of upside, but may need to raise money two or three times over the next couple of years in order to achieve their goals. And there are juniors out there that are either cash flowing or have such big cash positions relative to their monthly burn and their expected plans out in the field that one can reasonably expect them to go 2, 3, 4 years without raising financing. Again, that's not the average junior by any means. It's far less than 5% of them. But for one willing to do the work, there are some of these smaller names that present excellent upside in my estimation, but will not have to raise in the foreseeable future. So I think a perfectly valid strategy is for investors that are unable to participate in private placements to maybe confine their opportunity set to those type names. I will say for investors that are able to do private placements, there are a few things to look for of relevance. I'd say the first is, when did the company last finance? And I certainly would not recommend putting money into a company that's raised within the past 4 months, because as we know well, usually there's some major selling pressure with the 4 month hold period lifting, whether you like it or not. You'll often see investors strip the warrants, which is an unfortunate reality of how the junior Canadian market operates. A second thing I'd look for is how much of the financing is being taken down by company insiders. And preferably, you'll see participation that is at least equal to the existing board and management stake, particularly if members of board and management are independently wealthy. I wouldn't say it's an absolute deal breaker if this is not the case, but if the members of board and management have the means to participate, it's certainly at least a yellow flag if they're not taking their pro rata share of the deal. Another thing to look at is the other shareholders coming in. Are they people that you like to invest alongside and that you've made money alongside previously? Or are the known warrant clippers coming in, as you mentioned, Chad? You want to invest along high quality investors and not those that are going to clip the warrant and then prance off to the next deal. And then, you know, along those lines, you also want to see participation by existing shareholders to the highest degree possible. This is called signaling, and it's usually not great signaling if none of the company's existing investors are willing to write a check for the upcoming financing. So that's a thing to keep in mind. Also look for any major share escrow periods lifting in the near future, particularly within the 4 month hold period. You really shouldn't be buying if you expect significant insider selling anyhow, but this is one level of protection to make sure that there's no big blocks of shares becoming free trading while you're restricted with your stock. And then I'd also say, probably most importantly, from an investment standpoint, is to ask the company how long the money will last. And then also, are they raising enough to answer at least one unanswered question that you think as an investor has a significant chance, if answered in the affirmative, to drive the company's share price? If not, even if you really like the people involved, the asset, the story setup, but you do not expect there to be a significant unanswered question or catalyst in the calendar between now and the next raise, why not just sit on your hands and then talk to the company in 6 or 9 months when they raise again? So those are some of the more tactical things that I'm thinking about when I'm looking at a private placement.
Let's dive even further into that final point you made there, because look, this rebound, as we've noted in these stocks, is all just because the market has rebounded. A lot of these companies didn't have any news or didn't put out any significant news over the last 2 months, and their stocks have rebounded, mostly because there's just been a better metals price and a little bit more interest coming into the sector. What sort of work are you looking for that can actually drive these stocks and have them outperform the market rather than just having this rising tide lift their stock?
Yeah, great question. I mean, it is truly company specific, but some of the classic catalysts that one would expect to see in the junior space. I mean, there's nothing more impactful than a drill rig, particularly when a company's more in the exploration phase and they're either trying to make a grassroots discovery or they found something potentially of merit and are trying to prove to the market that it has both the size and the grade to justify future development. Of course, infill drilling for a later stage story could be less impactful, but I'd say at the top of the list is a drill program or two to drive value for a given story. Another thing to look for would be a partner or two coming in. Maybe this is more relevant to the prospect generator model or to a royalty generator or to a company with a couple different projects. You may catch wind that there's interest from partners on one or two of the non-core assets. And those can, if it's the right partner, you know, with the right terms, willing to go to work quickly and not sit on the given asset, that can also be a catalyst that's significant and can drive share price. For later stage names, you could look for a permit. Particularly if it's a project that's deemed controversial or permitting is not assured in the eyes of the market. And for the latest stage names, it could be construction financing. There are stories out there that have a feasibility study out. In theory, they're ready to break ground and go for it. And so if you're invested in the story at that stage, you're waiting for either A, that construction financing package to fall into place without it being too dilutive for existing equity holders, or B, for a larger party to come in and take that company out entirely. So again, it's very dependent on where the company is within the development cycle, but those are some of the key catalysts that one could you know, presumably look for within the sector.
Well, Matt, you've got your ear to the ground on this sector, and you talk to a lot of companies, a lot of different management teams and investing capital teams. And it seems interesting to me that the last couple of years, we've kind of been in a bear market, you could say, in the precious metal stocks, but even some of the base metal stocks as far as the junior side of the business. And a lot of companies raised a lot of money, blew a lot of money, did a lot of work, some would argue a lot of quality work, but it just didn't get rewarded. Now it seems like the sentiment is shifting and people are finally getting interested in the sector. And most of the companies that we're talking to are doing limited drill programs, or they're scaling back and they're not doing as much work. So they did a ton of work when nobody cared. And now that people cared, they're getting ready to do very little work. What do you make of that dichotomy?
Yeah, well, it is ruthless. And in bear markets, good news can often be used as a liquidation event for frustrated shareholders. It's perverse, but it happens bear cycle after bear cycle. But that's an opportunity for investors to go back and look at the companies that have achieved significant catalysts, have created significant value at their projects over the past 2 years, maybe weren't rewarded at the time. You know, maybe their share prices are up 50% off of the lows so far this year, but there still could be value, residual value from the work that was done 2 years ago. I think to your point about companies sitting on their hands or scaling back programs, I think that will change. I think that's more of a backward looking temptation from current management teams, just given the pain that we've gone through over the past two and a half years, particularly amongst the precious metal names. So I think as financing conditions improve, and you know, as you've mentioned, this is the opening of a financing window. We've seen a raft of junior financings here in the past 2 or 3 weeks. I think that window will likely remain open for some time. I do think we'll see companies upsizing their deals and starting to get more aggressive, but it may take some time for that mentality to change. And I would also, just when you're looking at a given name and you're seeing a share price move, really draw the distinction. Has this move been caused by a fundamental development at the company level that is justifying this move? Or is it truly just based off of a change in sentiment? And if you're a shareholder of said name, if it's a transformative company development, then you need to sharpen the pencil and rework what you think the company's fair value is and rework where you're going to begin to take profits. And if it's truly based on sentiment, then that means maybe you should be more inclined to take some money off the table get your cost base off the table and then play with the house's money at that point. So I think anytime you're analyzing a share price move within a given company, you should ask yourself that question. Is this a change in sentiment that's causing it, or did something actually happen that has changed the company's value for the better?
So a lot of times when investors are looking at these junior stocks too, rightfully or wrongfully so, they are looking for some sort of a takeover, some M&A to free up their capital, give them a premium on their investment. We haven't seen many M&As in terms of the junior companies, and we're still hearing from a lot of the majors that they're not really looking down to the juniors. It's been the mid-tiers that have dabbled in some of the junior companies, but those have been more established companies as well. So, Matt, should investors, one, be focused or hope for M&A when they are investing in a junior stock? What's your outlook for M&A potentially picking up for the junior companies?
Sure. Well, it's a style of investing, and I think there's quite a bit of merit to it. So we have, you know, companies that fall into multiple buckets within our portfolio. One of the buckets I would consider the high quality development stories, and those are companies where at spot metal prices, their projects make a lot of sense on paper. Maybe there's some uncertainty into whether they'll be permitted. You know, there's clearly still work to be done to get it through feasibility to actually get it to the point where there's ground to be broken. But there's a style of investing where one goes and looks for these high quality projects that are likely in the trough, hopefully in the trough of the Lassonde curve. You don't want to buy them after the initial discovery hype only to ride it down. But there are quite a few projects out there that have been neglected just because they're in the boring phase of development, but have a decent chance of making it into production over the next five or 10 years. So I think that's a certain style of investing. And if you're to hold those types of names, there are two things that you would look for. The first would be a takeover, as you say. And the second would be the company bringing it to a production decision. And if they have the in-house expertise to take that project forward, that's all the better. That creates some competitive tension, so to speak, with potential acquirers. I mean, any company worth their salt is always going to threaten to build the mine. But some teams have that skill set and some teams don't. But for some of these companies where the teams do credibly have the skill set, where if a proper offer does not emerge, you know, between, say, the pre-feasibility stage and say the feasibility study coming out, if they can threaten to actually build the thing, that helps investors from that perspective. So if you're looking at this niche of the market, those are the two big things that one could expect to create value. You know, very so often you'll have an occasion where there's a later stage development project. You know, you think it's a deposit of a certain size, of a certain production profile, and then they get lucky with the drill bit and find something either elsewhere on the property, or they find a new zone that was unexpected. That shouldn't be, you know, one's thesis, unless you have some very, you know, very specific intel that's within the realm of possibility. But on rare occasions, that can be a very, very pleasant experience where you're investing in what looks like a good project at good value, and then unexpectedly, it gets a lot better.
All right, Matt, all great comments. Thank you very much for sharing kind of what you're doing in the sector, how you're looking at these junior companies, and all the financings that we are seeing, and a lot that were announced this week and undoubtedly going to continue to be announced as long as these financing windows remain open. These companies need money, and they need money just to keep the lights on, and then further money to go do some programs here to actually move their projects forward. Always a pleasure chatting with you, Matt. Again, you can check out Matt over at the MJG Capital website, which we will link to within that weekend show posting. We'll chat with Matt again next month. Matt, thank you for your time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments where we focus more on metals, resources, stocks, especially in these last two segments of the first hour. We are focused on energy as we are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. We're going to talk macro factors driving the oil price that was recently above $85, natural gas, which continues to be stuck in a pretty depressed price range, and a couple companies that Dan brought to our attention in his small cap growth portfolio. We're also going to highlight a luncheon that Dan is hosting in Houston with In Play Oil. Dan, let's start off with the oil price here. Oil earlier this week moved above $85 a barrel, up to about $87 a barrel as we're talking Wednesday, halfway through the day. It has pulled back a little bit. Have to ask kind of big picture question. What a lot of people were talking about heading into this week was the escalating conflict in the Middle East. How much war premium do you think, Dan, is currently in the oil price as it is now right around that $82 to $83 a barrel?
Well, it kind of always runs up on those kind of, and it wasn't a rumor, obviously, they did get attacked. So I ran, when I saw that happen, I thought, you know, it may be $100 oil or something on Monday. I think now we're sitting back thinking that because, you know, Israel was able to knock down 99% of the deals and had very little damage from that attack, maybe, you know, they're okay, and maybe they're not going to respond. I got to believe they are going to respond. I mean, think about if somebody lobbed 350 freaking rockets into the U.S. or something. I mean, you can't just not respond to it. So they could do something if they want to, but for them to attack, they would need support from U.S. military, because the U.S. military would have to take out or jam a lot of the air defense systems in Iran for Israel to do it. I mean, maybe it'd just be Israeli jets going in there, but we would have to help them get through the air defense of Iran. So maybe that's why I do think it got a little ahead of itself. A lot of times when you get this geopolitical risk premium in oil, if things don't happen pretty quickly, then it pulls back. So I think 87, I mean, 6 weeks ago, I was just hoping that oil would average, you know, 80 during the quarter. And then it, you know, went way above 85. So I raised the, you know, the price I'm using in my forecast models is 82.50. But then I do think that oil is going to go quite a bit higher because demand for refined products, transportation fuels continue to drain storage. Our inventories of gasoline and diesel are both below where they should be for this time of year.
Yeah, Dan, I think some of those refined products, there is a choke point. But when you look at the oil price, a lot of market participants and possibly even some of the algo bots just look at the inventory builds. And we did get some updated numbers there. We had a guest on the show last week that was mentioning we may see a pullback in oil, not just because of the geopolitical cooling down a little bit, but just because of the builds. Could you maybe speak to that angle, the supply-demand part of it?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of in a period of time of the, you know, crude oil is the feedstock for the refineries, and you got a period coming up this summer, driving season, where there's going to be higher demand for gasoline. There's always a lot of demand. There's a lot of demand for diesel for planting. You know, farmers use a lot of diesel equipment, and they need a lot of feedstock. So you got oil 1 or 2% below normal for this time of year. It doesn't seem like much, but OECD inventories are very low for this time of the year, and really, the oil market is global. So where the U.S. gas market is an island, U.S. and Canada, North America, let's say, is kind of an island and doesn't have enough export capacity yet, but we're going to get more. So it's more global stuff that does it. But, you know, these companies are all making a lot of money at over 80. They're very, very profitable at $80 oil.
So, Dan, broadly, we can say that the oil price is traded in a range here, really back to almost the third quarter of 2022, highs right around, let's say, 95 max and lows right into the about $65 range. We're at, I guess, slightly the higher end of this trading range. But again, this has been a sustainable, it seems like, trading range. What are the catalysts that could break the oil price out either to the upside up towards that $100 a barrel, or that could actually be a hamper and move the oil price down to potentially those mid-60 levels?
Well, I think when the reality sinks in that U.S. oil production is going to peak, and I'm seeing more and more that you guys have HFI research up there, they're saying they don't see U.S. oil production getting over 14 million barrels a day. So there's this belief that we just got to go out and, you know, run a bunch of rigs and drill a bunch of you know, more shale wells or something, and we can increase it. Well, every year you got all these other existing wells on steady decline. So the more and more that you rely on, especially the shales that have high decline rates, the more and more wells you have to drill every year just to hold production flat. And I would say today we're not really completing enough wells today that's going to be able to hold production flat for much longer. So I think we are going to have a peak. You know, Adam Rosenzweig, which I think you've watched his stuff before, he's been touting for a long time that by the end of this year or early 2025, the Permian Basin is going to peak. If the Permian Basin peaks, there's no, you know, oil growth in the U.S. is pretty much done. Now, you know, maybe we'll come up with some, you know, new technologies or something. There's still a lot of oil in place, but there's no, the cheap oil is gone. I mean, there's no more $20 oil or $30 oil. And I would honestly say, you said that range, I used to tell people, if you want to run a low case on looking at a drilling program or something, run it at $50 oil. That'd be low. And, you know, it's maybe 70s, you're where you think it's going to be. And then maybe 80 or 90 for your high case. I think the base case now you'd have to say is 60. I can't see oil. You know, we'd have to have a major recession for oil to go back down to 60 and stay there. And then these companies, if we're at $80 oil, they are extremely profitable.
Yeah, Dan. And I think a lot of the companies we're factoring in, maybe we'd still get stuck in that $60 to $70 range. So I think they're pretty happy with oil in the 80s. But to your point about the Permian Basin possibly peaking out, that may happen down the road. But right now, the U.S. is still outputting a ton of oil. And last year was one of the biggest output years of all time. And with that much oil drilling, there's also a lot of nat gas that comes as a result. So maybe could you give us an update on the nat gas markets as a result of all this oil production?
Well, in the Permian Basin now, gas prices are almost zero. The pipes are full. They have no more takeaway capacity. So they got a problem out there and they need more pipe. And, you know, we got a government that tries to block every freaking pipeline they want to build. So that hurts. So, yeah, you got that. You got all these wells being drilled for oil, but they produce a lot of rich gas, like high BTU gas. So it's good gas and you got a lot of liquids in it, you know, propanes, butanes and stuff in it. So that's really good, but we need more market. I think what we're going to see in gas, what's going to get gas prices going up, when they start bringing on, and there's like five or six LNG export facilities that are set to come online over the next 2 years. In fact, a big one called Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana, is coming online just in the next few months, and it adds another 2 BCF per day of capacity. The current problem is that several of these LNG export facilities like Cheniere and, you know, some of the other big ones, they're doing some maintenance. They're down for maintenance. So feedstock demand for LNG export feedstock is down a little bit. So that's the current problem. We got a surplus really, and we've got to work it off, but, you know, market forces they'll take care of it eventually.
Yeah. Well, natural gas, boy, oh boy, it just really seems stuck. Everyone's pointing to these LNG terminals that are being built, but doesn't seem like the market's looking ahead to those right now. Let's talk about the overall size of these markets. You brought up a very interesting stat to us before we recorded about the size of the natural gas market, but also tie it into the oil market. What sort of growth have we seen broadly in terms of production and demand in both oil and natural gas market size?
Well, you know, the EVs are not going to have the impact on lowering gasoline and diesel that they thought. So if that's still going up, our gasoline and diesel inventories are lower than normal in the United States. Demand remains very high. And there's, you know, nothing that I see that's going to reduce demand. It would take like a global recession to dilute or reduce oil demand much. And I just don't see that happening. We're just not spending enough money. So you're not bringing on enough new supply to really keep up with rising demand. And I think IEA especially has been understating demand. Several people have sent letters we've had congressmen and stuff send letters to IEA in Paris telling them that, hey, you guys need to get your act together. You're underestimating this, because even EIA, our Department of Energy, has raised their demand forecast several times. So I don't see that. Now, on the natural gas side, I think everybody needs to realize this AI and crypto mining stuff is incredibly demanding for electricity. They are the only way to meet this growing electricity demand is to build a lot more natural gas fired power plants and maybe these modular, smaller nuclear power plants. And I don't know anything about that, but I mean, we're going to need a lot of natural gas power plants, even down in Texas. We're going to need them. You know, our population is growing. We got all these people from California moving here and businesses moving here. So that's going to increase our electricity demand. But, you know, I mean, just think about it. All we're really doing with EVs and everything, they just want to electrify everything. You know, they even want to ban gasoline fired lawnmowers and make us all use electric lawnmowers. So it's got to come from somewhere. It doesn't just come from out of the air. So you got to generate it.
It's a great point, Dan. There's going to have to be a lot more electricity generation. But just one more question on the oil side of things, or maybe even nat gas, is the global picture. I mean, we always talk about OPEC plus, the plus being Russia and some of those other rogue countries. You've got some other South American countries that have started ramping up production a little bit more, as well as some Middle Eastern countries. Is there any other country that could swamp the market with excess supply that would pressure the oil price?
Well, their IEA is saying the supply growth is going to come from the U.S., Canada, Brazil, and maybe Guyana or something, you know, Suriname or whatever. There's a few other little areas that have some upside of supply growth, but it looks like to me demand's going to go up by 1.5-2 million barrels per day year after year after year, and probably through at least 2030, just because of population growth. I mean, the more people, more demand for electricity. You know, more EVs, more cell phones is going to be more electricity, and you're just going to have to keep going. But that's more gas, and we don't burn much oil to generate electricity. But it's just, you know, transportation fuel is always a big deal, and it's going to keep going up.
Well, I'm sure we're going to continue to see countries, including the U.S., try to keep their production higher, especially in these higher price environments. The companies are making money, and, well, they do then start to focus a little bit more on growth since they have really cleaned up their balance sheets. Dan, before we get into some of the companies that you want to highlight with us, I do want to give a little shout out to an upcoming luncheon that you're hosting in Houston this Tuesday, April 23rd. You're featuring In Play Oil. Tell us how some of our listeners can get involved in this luncheon if they're in the Houston area, please.
Okay. If you just go to our website, which is energyperspectives.com, just energyperspectives, one word, no space in there, .com. You can go on, and then all you do is click on the deal to register. Now, this one, we're in a smaller room, so our seating is limited to 40, and I think as of this morning, we had like 30 people registered. But, you know, we'd love to have you come, and the CEO of the company is going to be doing it. In Play is one of my top picks in our high-yield income portfolio. It pays monthly dividends, and, man, it's got a lot of really good running room. And one thing I didn't mention, you know, that Trans Mountain pipeline that's just recently been completed up there has significantly increased the oil prices that are getting paid to the upstream companies, because that pipeline ramping up is de-bottlenecking all of Western Canada. So the oil price in Canada are going up with WTI price increase, but they're also getting another $5 or $6 a barrel up increase because of the Trans Mountain pipeline.
All right, Dan, I appreciate you breaking that down. And you did provide us with two companies that are small cap growth companies in the oil patch. And the first one that we want to look at together is Riley Exploration Permian, ticker REPX. This is a pure play in the Permian Basin, which we were just talking about. So hopefully the Permian doesn't peak out too early here. But it's a nice growth company. There's a lot on the go with the company. Maybe break down some of the key catalysts you think will be in play in the year to come.
And really, a lot of these companies, they do have upside production growth. It's just that the Permian Basin is totally leased out. And a lot of the production growth in the last couple of years came from private companies, but they don't have any acreage left. They've kind of run out of acreage out there. So anyway, I've been following this company for a couple of years. They came to my attention when I heard they had the potential for a CO2 flood out there. And I worked for Hess for 18 years, and we at one time had the most successful CO2 flood in the world. And they have an area where they have the same formation, the San Andreas formation, that is perfect for CO2 floods. It's a sandstone, and you mix CO2 with water, and it goes through there and can really do it. So that's looking better. That's looking good. The pilot program's going good. And on that, they expect to publish a feasibility study by the end of the year to expand it what it would cost to expend it to the whole field. But regardless of that, what I really like about them is they have closed, are now establishing a new core area over in New Mexico, southeastern New Mexico in Eddy County, which Eddy County is actually known for some of the best shale wells in the world. In the world are being drilled in Eddy County. These are wells that EOG and Matador and some of the other biggies are completing. They're coming on at 5,000-7,000 barrels a day wells. But Riley is focused on shallower zones. They've got an area where now they have built up like 24,000-25,000 acres. They've closed one big acquisition, and now they're going to close a bolt on that's going to like double their acreage in this play. Going forward, about 40% of their oil production, or total production, is going to be coming from New Mexico, and about 60% from their legacy assets that are in Yoakum County. They're right on the border between Texas and New Mexico. So both of these areas are close together, and they have strong production growth, increased production by 33%. Year over year in 2022, and another 61% year over year in 2023. And it looks like they're going to be adding double digit production growth just from drilling programs for the next several years. Fourth quarter 23 production was 19,924 BOE per day, about 60% oil. This company is heavily weighted to oil, so the low gas price up there doesn't hurt. Now, if gas prices do improve, it could significantly increase their revenues, but I'm not modeling that to happen for at least the next 2 years. But anyway, it generates free cash flow. They already pay a dividend. It was a private company that was built, you know, on these drilling programs and stuff, and those guys were having nice quarterly distributions out of those partnerships. So when they went public, they had to keep paying a dividend. And they told me, I just talked to them on Tuesday, that their plan is to increase their dividend 5% per year. That's their goal. And they definitely have the running room to do that. But they're going to be generating like 3 or 4 times more free cash flow than their current dividend. So they could raise it a lot more, but they're going to use the excess. They told me their focus was going to be to pay down debt that they incurred to do these acquisitions. Now, the last acquisition they did, or the one that they're closing in May, I'm sorry, they're working on closing it real quick. And they did an equity raise, which kind of stunned the market. You know, recently small caps have not been able to raise equity or sell stock, and they were able to do that. They're going to buy that with that equity raise, which I love, and keeps the balance sheet in balance, and they're going to have a lot of free cash flow. So it looks good. Again, briefly on the CO2 flood that's underway, they've got like two horizontal injectors and four vertical injectors that's driving the, you know, water. It's water plus CO2. It's increasing in that area the production, so that looks good. They're going to get together a bunch of data from these wells and then see what that's going to cost. But another thing they got that really looks exciting to me, and I talked about them on Tuesday, they've established a new company called RPC Power LLC, and they've hooked up with another power company that has modular power generating facilities. And what they really look like is a railroad train car. And you can get our boxcar thing, and you can hook these things together as much as you want. So you can put power generation right in the field. So the gas coming out of the ground, it has to be, you know, processed a little bit to get the liquids out of it. And then that gas just goes right into these, you know, modulars to generate electricity. And they are already generating 36% of the electricity they're using in Texas is being generated by this new facility. And that alone is going to, first of all, you know, they don't have to worry about pipeline capacity for their gas or anything. So they're selling their gas out of the ground to this new company and then getting their electricity for virtually free. So that's going to lower their operating expenses there. And there's a lot of interest in this technology because they do have regular power outages out in West Texas. They get a lot of their power from wind and solar way out there in the middle of nowhere, really. And they can't happen. And a lot of their wells have submersible electric pumps in them. And so if they lose power, they can have wells have to be shut in. And so that's very costly. So this is a very good thing for them. And I think it's going to spread. I think a lot of other companies are going to start doing this. So that's got that upside. But I really like it. I think it's my valuation is about double where it's trading now. It's at about 27 or 8 here on Wednesday. And my valuation on it is $50 a share.
Okay, I was going to ask you where you stood in terms of price, dividend forecast, even debt outlook, but you've kind of covered those there for us. Very cool initiative there of how they're developing their own power, generating their own power on site, a whole other aspect of the company. Let's move on to Surge Energy then. Traded SGY on the TSX. This is a Calgary-based upstream company. Again, also in your small cap growth portfolio. They pay actually a higher dividend right now than Riley Exploration does at just over 6%. Take us through some of the high-level fundamentals on Surge, what you like about them.
Yeah, I started following this a couple of years ago, and they came down and hosted one of our luncheons, and I've had them on a couple of webinars, and I just really like this team, and they've really got something going out. They have an area called Sparky. It's in Saskatchewan, and they own a bunch of acreage there, and they've been completing these multilateral horizontal wells. So they drill down, they case the well vertically, and then from the bottom of that pipe, they drill several. They drilled 12 laterals. And so these laterals may go out another half mile or so in all different directions and at different depths. And so basically they're just opening up a lot more pore space in the zone. They actually, in I think it was the fourth quarter, they reported some of the best producing, best economic wells in all of Saskatchewan were their wells. So they look really good. They're up to 25,000 BOE per day. And they're very heavily weighted to oil. The current share price, the yield is 6.1%, and I expect them to increase. They've told me when they reach these debt reduction targets, which with, you know, the current oil price, they're going to reach these debt reduction targets that they have by mid-year within a few months. And so I expect them to raise their dividend. I mean, they've publicly told the market in a bunch of presentations that they're going to raise the dividends later this year. Strong production growth, again, 20.5% year-over-year production growth in 22, and another 15% production growth in 2023. What happens in these small caps, these Canadian juniors, and the U.S. small caps as well, when they get to certain thresholds, and 20,000, 25,000 barrels per day is where the market starts thinking of you as a mid-cap, not a small cap, but a mid-cap, and so you get higher valuations. You know, the market just starts thinking that, you know, they'll pay 5 times cash flow or 6 times cash flow instead of where these guys are trading, which is like 2 or 3 times cash flow at this point. I've never seen companies of this quality trade at such incredibly low multiples of cash flow before. So it looks really good, and they got a lot of running room. And again, the opening of the Trans Mountain Pipeline has also increased their netbacks on their wells. So they're going to have a nice revenue surge here in the second quarter.
Well, Dan, just to the point you just made about the small caps, once they finally graduate up to, let's say, a mid cap because of their production, don't they also go on the radars of larger companies as potential takeover targets at that point in time?
I've heard that there's a lot of talk in Canada of there being an increase in M&A this year. And what will happen is, you know, these big companies, they have to go out there and keep getting more acreage. They have to add inventory. I mean, if they run out of drilling locations, they're screwed. So they got to keep doing it. And Surge has a lot of them. So they'd be on my radar screen. I used to do this for Hess. I looked for companies for takeover targets. And actually, when you can acquire leasehold, and especially leasehold held by production, that is very, very valuable. And that's what I like. Oh, and that's one thing I wanted to tell you. I didn't mention on Riley. Riley, this acreage that they've got over in Eddy County, all of the acreage in the play that they're wanting to develop is 100% held by production. And that is extremely important. And I think on most of the acreage, they do hold the deep rights. So they may not be interested in drilling 8,000-10,000 foot, you know, horizontal wells that are $7 or $8 million, but somebody is, and Eddy County is really, so they could farm out those, you know, they could sell off or make some kind of deals with their deep rights if they control a lot of good acreage up there. And again, if any of your listeners, you want to see some of the best wells in the world, just look at what EOG is reporting, what Matador is reporting, and they're reporting those big wells in Eddy County. So it's a good, good area.
All right, Dan, great chatting with you. Thank you, as always, for sharing your thoughts on the energy sector, the energy prices, as well as the stocks that have your attention and some of your research on those stocks. Again, if anyone wants more information on the Energy Prospectus Group, I'll post a link to the website. You can also email Dan and his team at energyprospectus@gmail.com, where you can find out more about that upcoming Houston luncheon and any of the future luncheons as well. So Dan, thank you very much for joining us on this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on our website and podcast to this first hour. Hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. Be sure to check out our website, podcast, and YouTube channel for all the daily editorials and company updates we recorded throughout the week. Everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.